Well, alrighty, gang, welcome back to the Active Self-Protection Podcast. I am, as always, your host, Mike Williver, and with any luck at all, I remain your favorite former Fed. With us today, a new friend of mine. Actually, not a new friend of mine. I've known this gentleman on Facebook for a while. I've gotten to see a little peek into his family life and his professional life, and I am a fan of his already, and was before he wrote in. But he decided to write in with a story. And again, as usual, you know, he wasn't sure if the story was worthy of the show and all that sort of thing. And I'm telling you, I have very few people that write in that I don't think we could make a show out of. So if you're thinking about it, Mike at ActorSelfProtection.com, give me a shout. And the worst thing I can say is no. So his name is Dig, by the way. That's not his real name. It's a nickname, but it fits. He looks like if anyone looked like a Dig, it's this guy. How are you, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing well. So Dig hails from northern Arizona, which is a beautiful part of the country. I'll turn my watch off here. If you've never been up there, it's a crazy place. The different geography, what's the word I'm looking for?
Topography.
Yeah. Microclimates, whatever you want to call it, but it's extremely varied. And I think most people think that Flagstaff is all the way at the top of the state of Arizona, but it's really not. There's a lot more above there, including the Navajo Nation, and then getting up towards the Grand Canyon. It's really, really beautiful. So if you get a chance, if you're driving on your way to through there or whatever, take a minute, stop and look around. It's gorgeous. But don't move to Arizona. It's terrible here. You wouldn't like it at all, wherever you're coming from. Yeah, it's sweet. We hate it. So he is married with two kids. And he wanted to mention he has an older daughter who is an adult and moved out and happily married, and a younger son. And I think your son was the one who prompted you to write to me. Is that right?
Yes, he actually was.
Would you mind if we mentioned his first name?
No, not at all. His name is Akash, and he enthusiastically is a fan of Active Self-Protection, and he always wants to watch the age-appropriate videos. He's always asking me, Dad, is this one appropriate for me? Dad, is this one appropriate for me? Actually, John had on the YouTube channel, I believe he still has a playlist dedicated to videos that are age appropriate for kids, lessons for kids. And I think Akash has watched most, if not all, of those.
So I just learned something. I didn't know that was a thing. So I work here. I didn't even know that existed. So good to know. There you go. There's your top tip for the day. So thank you to him for doing that. And again, your job, I'm going to give everyone 2 seconds who are watching on the app to get an idea of what he does for a living. Go. Okay, so there's guitars hanging behind you on the wall, and they're not normal looking guitars. They're really, really detailed. It's fascinating looking. I know what you do because I've seen you on Facebook. He is a pyrographer. Would you call that? Is that safe to say?
Yes, sir.
I've never heard that word before today, or the art of pyrography, but it is gorgeous, detailed, and really, really exquisite. So tell the folks what that means and what it is you do.
Well, in my case, I create custom wood-burned art on guitars for folks. And I came to that from 20 years of high-level tattooing. I was tattooing at a high level in terms of, like, folks would come from around the world to get work done with me. I was booked out often a year in advance. And when I moved away from working on human bodies, I transitioned to working on guitar bodies. And there's a lot of things that cross over from one medium to the other. Okay. In terms of creating art that's custom designed for the individual based on their input, based on their life experiences, based on what's important to them. So all of those things go into the guitar design. They used to go into the tattoos that I would do, and now they go into the artwork that I do on people's guitars. And people are passionate about their guitars as they are about their music. And it's really fascinating to see the ideas that people come up with and the trust that they put in me to render these designs in a way that they're going to love. And basically these instruments, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as the clients are concerned, become heirlooms that can be passed down for generations. And an important note, a lot of people are like, well, how does that affect the sound of the guitar? And I would say that it's minimal to negligible. Like, most people who don't have a really trained ear aren't even going to notice a difference in the acoustic response. So that's good, because I definitely wouldn't be doing what I do if it didn't leave the instrument fully functional.
So I'm going to give a quick plug to the website. It is www. I'm not a boomer. I'm just saying that to be fun. It is sacred, sacredfirearts, all one word, SACREDFIREARTS, sacredfirearts.com. And so if somebody did want to reach out to you, they had their, you know, their baby Taylor and they wanted something meaningful on it, could they go to your website or how would they get a hold of you?
I'm on my website that you just mentioned, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, all of those under the same name, Sacred Fire Arts, Google search.
Do me a favor, do yourself a favor actually, and go check that out. Cause it really is it's very cool. There's no other way to put it. It's extremely cool. You know, my son is a guitar player. I'm a piano player. I have a concert grant. I'm going to need you to burn it up for me. No, I'm kidding. Have you ever done any other instruments? I'm curious, like a mandolin or a piano or something else, or has it always been guitars?
Guitars keep me very busy. I would be open to doing all sorts of other instruments if they were compatible. I've done ukuleles. I have a lot of clients in Australia, go figure, but I have some somewhat famous clients in Australia, and I've done drumsticks for one of them who's a drummer over there. And
very cool.
I'm trying to think what else I've done. Mainly guitars, ukuleles, the drumsticks.
But you're open to other things. That's good to know. So go check him out, sacredfirearts.com, and you won't be disappointed. If for no other reason, just to go and look at it, it's literally art. It's a piece of art when he's done with it. Can I ask you one more thing? I don't want to get too far afield on your occupation, but I think it's
fascinating. Sure, of course.
So my son has a Taylor guitar. People don't realize, if they're not in the music world, that a guitar can cost thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars. So to trust you with it, potentially destroying it if there is a problem or an accident, is a huge amount of trust. How do you start the process? Do you have to take the lacquer off first and sand it down to bare wood, or how does that work?
It depends on
the finish.
It depends on what's happening. Like, so for instance, in many cases, people will send me, I would say about half of the cases, people will send me a guitar that they already owned. You mentioned Taylor. So this is one that I'm about to be working on. This is a Taylor.
Okay.
And the person sent it to me. And this is probably about a $4,000 Taylor. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, I will remove the finish carefully and delicately and then create the art, and then I will refinish it. In other cases, other instances, I'll work directly with a luthier. A luthier is a guitar maker, a person who makes guitars. Okay. And in those instances, they can send me the parts of the guitar without finish on them. And then I'll send that back to them. So speaking of Australia, I've got a project that I'm working on with a luthier in Australia at the moment. I've done electric guitars where people will send me, a luthier will send me the body of the guitar. I'll wood burn that, send it back to them. They'll finish it with all the fancy doohickeys and whatnot. Yeah, so it just depends.
Very cool. Well, go check it out. Do me a favor. You won't regret it. It's nice to look at. It's easy on the eyes. So, so normally I would start off by asking about your self-defense history. And if you were self-defense minded for a long time, when did it start? But your story, actually, there's two stories. There's an earlier story from when you were younger, and then one that's slightly more recent. And the one more recently sort of kicked you off on your self-defense journey. So we'll save that, I think, if I understood your message correctly.
Well, actually, I would say that I've been, as you say, self-defense minded since I was really young. Like, since I would say that started when my mom put me into karate when I was about 10 years old. And that really kind of opened my eyes to the world of self-defense, to the concept of being one's own self-defender. I was also really fortunate at that point in time to have a sensei, an instructor, who emphasized the mental component of being a self-defender and how it was not an offense, it was a defense. And your main defense is run away, walk away, de-escalate. Sure. Remain calm. Yeah. And, you know, so to learn at an age of 10, when I was really like struggling, like emotionally at the age of 10, my parents had just gone through a big divorce and it was messy and all that. And it was an island in a storm for me finding that refuge of martial arts. And I think that having a good instructor in martial arts, like anything else, can make or break your experience. And I had a great instructor who really, again, that was my first introduction to being able to use your breath to help modulate your thinking. And for me, that was a life changer, because I felt like I had no recourse to controlling the turbulence of my brain, of my mind. And so to find this and to find it through the vehicle of self-defense, martial arts, was really eye-opening. And that led to other things that have always remained consistent in this life, like things that John talks about on the channel, things that you guys talk about in terms of, like, you know, being situationally aware, alert of your surroundings, practicing de-escalation to the best of one's abilities, you know, and recognizing one's own shortcomings. And like you guys are always talking about, like, knowing what your draw time is, for instance, well, knowing what you're capable of in a situation so that you don't overestimate or say, okay, I'm not going to enter this situation because I have no skills in this area. So, yeah. Anyway.
Very cool. So the earlier incident happened, you mentioned it briefly in our pre-interview, in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Now, I went to investigator school with a guy who was a special agent for my old agency down in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I think I had always thought before I talked to him, and I think most people who've never been probably think it's just this wonderful, idyllic place, like out of a Sandals commercial, and there's probably very little crime. And that's actually not entirely true. So kind of walk us through what happened to you back then.
I am sorry, you broke up for about 30 seconds there.
Oh, no worries. I'll reset. This happens. Technology. It is what it is. He's on Northern Arizona Wi-Fi. He's probably getting 6 megs down or something like that. All right. No, I was going to say, when I went to investigator school years ago, probably 20 years ago, one of the guys in my academy class had been stationed in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I think most people who've never been, and I think I thought before I talked to this guy that it's just this wonderful, idyllic place with zero crime. And it's like a Sandals resort commercial and everything's great. It's actually not true. It wasn't back then. I don't know about now, but kind of walk us through what happened back then and what it made you think about.
Well, so a couple of things. First of all, I have family in both the U.S. and the British Virgin Islands, which are like right next. They're only divided by water. They're like right next to each other. But, The specific incident that we're going to talk about briefly happened in the British Virgin Islands. But I wanted to mention something in regard to what you were saying about the crime rate of the United States Virgin Islands. I love the United States Virgin Islands. I love the Virgin Islands in general, British and United States. Mm-hmm. And they are idyllic. They are beautiful. They are paradise. They deserve that moniker. However, they're also a midpoint in the drug shipping routes from South America to North America. They have their own violence that spills over from places like Haiti and Jamaica and whatnot. And they're always intercepting boats that are loaded with narcotics and weapons. And that definitely infiltrates the society. And last I heard, Puerto Rico, which is a United States territory, and the United States Virgin Islands were leading the nation in, again, they're not states, but leading the nation in gun violence. And gun-related violence. So there's that. And again, that's not to say that anybody who wants to go there on a vacation shouldn't go there, because it's not like that. It's not like going to places in Mexico. But it is, and again, that's not to disparage Mexico either, because I've been there and it's a beautiful place. But it can be dangerous depending on what your situation is. So it's similar. Like, you know, the Virgin Islands are exquisite, but I think that it's easy to overlook or to not notice the level of crime that can happen there. And also the fact that ironically, the bad guys there don't have any problem getting guns. The good people there have a big problem getting firearms, which is something that I'm actually advocating for. We can wind back to my incident, but one of the things that I've really felt like has become kind of an important thing to me is preparing myself to advocate in front of the Virgin Islands, specifically the British Virgin Islands government, for people's right to keep and bear arms. Right now, it is so restricted and so hard. I wouldn't say impossible, but it's nearly impossible to own a firearm or ammunition or both. Again, for good people. Criminals have no problem. There's lots of guns on the islands. And part of what has really been part of my journey since I've transitioned from being a firearms owner to being someone who actively trains with firearms, is I'm preparing myself to be a better defender for my own self, for my family, for my community. But I'm also amassing credentials and credit hours in gun school. Mm-hmm. So that when I go in front of the governments of the Virgin Islands, that I have credentials, I have some validity, I'm able to reference things that give me some credibility in front of this government, and I'm preparing for that. And because, you know, my family and I would like to spend more time there, as my family here in Arizona would like to spend more time in the Virgin Islands as my family down there get older. And just because we love it down there, it's absolutely exquisite. It's beautiful down there. So these are things, you know, the idea of going someplace where all the bad guys have guns, but no good guys can defend them. You can't even have OC spray there. So I've been in talks with the deputy governor. I have meetings coming up on our next visit there with the firearms approval tribunal, because last time I was there, I started the whole process of becoming a legal firearms owner there, you know, which is way harder than anything that I've had to go through here in the States as somebody who owns, you know, who has a concealed carry permit here in Arizona too, which isn't even necessary in Arizona. But again, I'm doing all sorts of due diligence. So anyway, you wanted to mention, get to the point of my incident.
No, you're good.
So this particular incident that you mentioned, I would say that it was probably in 93 or 94. I was 23 or 24. And I was house sitting for my father. And my father lives in town, in the equivalent of what town is on a small island in the, on actually the main island in the British Virgin Island, but it's a relatively small island. I think it's like 28 miles by 11 miles. And it was so simple what happened. He was away. I was in a room at one end of the house, and I heard banging at the other end of the house. It's a two-story house, and I heard banging at the other end of the house. And my curiosity was piqued right away, and I was like, what's going on out there? And before I could even get out of the room I was in, I could tell that somebody had entered the house through a back door or a window. I don't remember exactly if they got in through. I think it was a door that they got in through. And without thinking, I just headed towards this intruder. So there was no thought of, let me arm myself. Again, I didn't have a firearm. I'm sure I had knives around at that point in time. I don't even think I had like a stick or a baseball bat or anything. So I was completely unarmed, headed towards the threat or the intruder, and saw somebody in our house. It was somebody who I was able to even identify the person, like in my brief glimpse of this person, I was able to say, I've seen this guy in an area of town that is known for drug deals, I'll say. And so just in passing through that area, like driving past, I would say, oh, look at, you know, there's those guys doing their shady business, and noticing who they were, I saw one of the people I recognized, and I was like, ooh, what the heck? And I started yelling. I can't quite recall, you know, how the memory can be, especially over a 20-year time span. I don't remember exactly what I was yelling, but I was basically saying, get the bleep out of the house, you know, what are you doing, kind of thing. And I didn't have much time to yell, because the person looked at me, thought about what he was going to do. And I don't know what he was thinking about in his drug-addled brain, but he decided to leave. And that was the extent of the encounter. I called the police. I called my dad. I'm like, Dad, this happened. What would you like me to do? We agreed that I should call the police. I called the police, dealt with it, but there wasn't a whole lot that they could do about it, because, you know, nothing had happened. The person whoever broke in probably thought no one's home. There was no car in the garage or in the outdoor garage. And what's significant about this to me, because I didn't even remember this experience until I wrote into you about the other experience that we'll talk about, is that this is one of those situations that could have gone horribly wrong or horribly different than what it did. So it was grace that it didn't go that way, but I had no, even though I had some martial arts in my past, I wasn't thinking of this person could be armed. This person might, obviously, if they broke into a house, they might not have, they don't have the same moral compass as I do, and they might be willing to take it to the next level. You don't know what kind of door you're opening up when you confront somebody like that. And when I started thinking about it, I'm like, you know what? I was really fortunate that that person wasn't armed, didn't decide that it was worth him to commit violence against me. And I don't really know what else I would have done. This was like cell phones were fledgling that time. I didn't have one. It wasn't like I could call for help. And short of barricading myself in the room as another option, I don't know what else I could have done other than confront this person. But it's a sobering reminder that you just never know what you're going to encounter when that happens. And again, feeling grateful that that's all that happened, that I scared somebody off who had the audacity to break into our house. That's, you know.
What time of day was this, roughly?
This was probably around 4 or 5 p.m.
That's actually pretty unusual. Who knows, you know, did they ever catch this guy or no?
No, they did not.
Okay, so the reason that's unusual is usually, I mean, the vast majority of burglaries happen during business hours for obvious reasons. That's when the bad guys think nobody's home. You know, you see a guy looking sketchy, riding his clearly stolen bicycle, looking like a parolee, which he probably is, riding through your neighborhood at noon. That's what he's doing, probably. He's probably looking to break into cars and or houses, hoping nobody's home. And you're right. There's no telling. It could be anything from this guy is drunk, high, or has a mental illness or something and thinks he's home and he's locked out and he broke in. It could be that. And then when you confront him or her, potentially, they're going to go, oh, no, and run away, or go, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm in the wrong house. As soon as I stepped foot, I realized that wasn't my couch. That wasn't my TV.
Right.
Up until someone who's willing to murder you. To get away with what they're doing, who have zero moral compass, as you said, no compunction about injuring or killing you. So our advice always is if you think there's someone in your house and there's no need to go out and confront them. So, you know, for example, if you've got three kids in three different rooms down the hall, well, you got to do something. You got to protect those kids, obviously. But if it's just you or just you and your significant other, and you can barricade yourself in a room and arm yourself and call the police and outsource your violence, yeah, you might lose a TV. You might lose a family heirloom, you might lose something important to you. But what you can't possibly predict is all the possible outcomes and variables of the scenario you're about to put yourself in by walking out there and confronting someone. Not the least of which is you have a completely and utterly justified deadly force incident and you shoot and kill somebody. And I think and you know who I'm talking about, Dig, there's a portion of the population that think that's pretty cool. And they wish somebody would break, you know, I wish a mother effer would, you know, break into my house and I'll do this and that. And I think those people aren't really playing it out in their head. They're not asking themselves, okay, what's it going to be like? Let's say I have this completely justified shooting. This guy's got a gun. He's aiming it at me and I shoot him and kill him. Okay. Well, now you're dealing with someone who's slowly bleeding to death. You haven't prepared yourself for the aftermath of this. It's going to be ugly. It's going to give you PTSD almost certainly. It's going to, for no other reason, the practical reason, it's going to create a huge mess all over your house that you get to clean up later because you just had to go confront the bad guy. I really recommend not doing that unless they're, you know, like I said, if there's a child's room or something, yeah, absolutely go do what you got to do. But otherwise, man, outsource your violence. I would much rather lose my flat screen or my grandma's vase, you know, that which sucks, right? I'd much rather do that than live through an incident like having to shoot and potentially kill somebody, or God forbid it doesn't go well and you get shot or killed, you get stabbed and killed. I can go on and on, but that's not what we're here to talk about.
No. So, and you know, as somebody who trains at this point pretty regularly with firearms, I am so clear about my mission is absolutely not to ever shoot anybody. If I can in any way, shape or form avoid it, that is the last thing on earth that I want to do, or that I want to have happen, or that I want to be involved in. There is no way that I want to bring that into my life or that I want to see that happen. However, if it ever does need to happen, and I use the word need,
right,
then I want to be fully, as much as possible, as you can prepare for that horrible worst day scenario, I want to be prepared for that. But I do have a question for you.
Sure.
My question is this. Based on what you said, as the act of self-protection recommendation, barricade yourself in a room, call for help, you know, get on the phone and call the police, arm yourself, outsource your violence. In that situation where I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have any form of any recourse to arm myself. And it was me and a potentially dangerous intruder in this house. What else could I have done other than barricade myself or confront the person? Like, I would be barricading myself in a room with no idea of how to get out. Or,
right.
What other option do you think
I think the next best option for someone in that position is to try to escape, if that's possible, to get out of the house, run to a neighbor's house, run wherever you can. I mean, fortunately, most people these days have a cell phone. Most people have it on them pretty much all day, no matter where they are. I know some people leave their cell phone in the living room and walk into the bedroom or whatever. I'm not one of those people. If you can find a way to get out of there, great. If the escape route means confronting the bad guy or going by the bad guy,
which it did in this case,
right? Try barricading yourself. There's no perfect answer, right, to anything.
There's no perfect answer.
I do want to go back to something you said a minute ago. There is that balance, right, between truly in your heart never ever wanting to have to shoot another human being or kill another human being in any manner, any way, shape, or form, and being ready for it. Like I've always said. You know, when I see stuff like today's video, today is April 2nd, 24. I don't know when this will come out, but today's video on the main channel is the Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas. And
oh, yes.
The response.
I saw that. I saw that early because I subscribed to the ASP Unlimited app.
My man.
Yes, sir.
That one, you know, there's no other word for it. A lot of cowardice, in my opinion. I hate to say that, but that's what I saw, was a lot of people frozen, unable to do their jobs. These are armed professionals. They're law enforcement officers or security professionals. And I don't want to be around a shooting. I don't want to shoot anybody, but if someone needs protecting, I want to be there. If that makes any sense. If someone barges into my church with a gun, I hope I'm there that day. Not because I want to shoot someone, because I want to protect someone. And that's kind of the sort of balancing act you have to pull off. To be an armed individual, an armed professional, is I really don't want to do this, but I absolutely will. And I know in my heart, I've had this conversation, I absolutely will do what I have to do to protect life, my life and the lives of other people. And that's sort of that warrior ethos, you know, who hates war more than anybody, soldiers, Marines, that's who, because they're the ones that have to do it. So at any rate, we're getting very poetic here, Dig. I feel like we should take a moment, find our center. And let's move on to the more recent incident, because that one, the one you wrote in about, I find to be fascinating. And I'm not going to preview it. I'll just let you run with it. About how long ago did it happen? And kind of walk us through it.
Okay, so this happened about 7 years ago. And we live, I would say, about 8 years ago. So no, actually, the incident happened about 6 years ago. And we moved. We bought this house that we're living in about 7 years ago.
Okay.
And we bought a house across the street from across the road. It's an unpaved dirt road. And we bought a house across the road from a home for adults who have high level autism.
Okay.
So I don't know how many residents they have over there exactly, but they have, it's a decent program. It's got I would guess maybe 15 to 20 maximum residents over there. And in terms of the ratio of residents to staff, I don't honestly know what that would be. But so the people there are, I think you, again, I'm not an expert in the field of mental health, but I would say that my estimation, and my wife is in mental and behavioral health, so I get some additional input, but I would say that they're probably considered high, I think the term would be high-end autism folks.
Okay.
And so that's a preface to what happens next. So we were literally, I think, sitting around one evening eating ice cream and watching TV, and we hear we'd had a few interesting interactions with the folks across the street, but nothing that became violent. And we're sitting at home eating ice cream and watching TV. And it's probably about, I want to say about 5 or 6 in the late afternoon, early evening, when I hear hollering outside. And I get up to go look, and there's one of the young men who's a resident at the house across the street has entered into our neighbor's property, and our neighbors have horses, and the horse corral is fenced in with horse fencing. So you can easily climb through the fencing, and I can see under the shed of the horse corral, this young man. I would estimate him as being between 18 and 23-ish, and he's tall, lanky, but clearly, as the story will illustrate, strong. And he's in there, and he's punching the horses in the face, like full out, like boxing the horses in the face. And I yell out, I'm like, "Hey, stop hitting the horses." And he doesn't respond. I yell out again, "Hey, stop hitting the horses." Mm-hmm. And I have to repeat that maybe 3-4 times. And at that point, his attention leaves the horses and comes to me. And I would say that there's probably between where the horses were and our front door, there's probably 100 feet.
Okay.
And he starts tearing towards me. So he runs, he jumps through the horse fence between the bars, mm-hmm. and proceeds towards our door. He does this with remarkable agility and speed. And I mention that specifically because there are residents over there who have difficulty just ambulating. So right. there's a spectrum of disability, if I may use that word.
Physical
and
agility.
So this guy was very agile, very physically fit, and he starts running towards me. At that point, one of the caretakers had been running up, and I hadn't noticed him because we have some bushes in our yard, and he ran, basically he was obscured, and then all of a sudden I saw him run out from behind the bushes and tackle this young man, or at least grab him. I don't think he took him down at that moment, but the guy who tackled him or who tried to restrain him was probably about 6'3" and really like burly, heavy set guy, mm-hmm. in his mid-30s, I would estimate. He grabbed him, tried to restrain him, and the young man, who was I'll call him the attacker at this point, started to attack his caretaker very violently, like punching. I didn't see him bite him, but he was very much super aggressive, kicking, screaming unintelligibly. And his caretaker had a really difficult time restraining him. At one point, they went to the ground, and I don't recall if it was because the caretaker intentionally took him to the ground or because the young man just like through the fighting, it went to the ground, but then it got quickly back onto the feet. And this guy who was the caretaker had a really hard time restraining the guy. This young man was intent on getting to us. And at one point, he broke free of the restraints. I'd say at that point, he was about 35 feet away from us. At one point, maybe less, maybe 20, 25, somewhere in that range.
When you say us, so are you, just paint us a picture, are you outside on a front porch? Is there other people with you, or what's going on your end?
I had opened, we had a solid door, and we had a screen door, not a metal screen door.
Not a security door, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Just a screen door with glass on it. And I had opened, the metal door was open. It was like late summer or something along those lines. And I had opened the screen door so I could yell out the door and say, "Hey, stop hitting the horses." And as this fight was happening, my son, who was then like 3 or 4, had come over, and my wife had come over too. They were observing. I want to say that at this point, I had closed the screen door that had glass on it and screen. Mm-hmm. So it was glass and screen. And we're looking out and we're observing this struggle going on in our basically where we park our cars, but we didn't have our cars parked there at that moment. And at one point, this young man, the attacker, got free of the caretaker's grips and started to run towards us again. And the caretaker was able to like grab him by his lower part of the body. The caretaker had taken quite a beating, by the way, just from trying to, and I would say, let me think in terms of time, how long this went on. From the time that I called, called out to the young man to stop hitting the horses, to the time that they ended up scrapping in our yard, I would say it was maybe 20 seconds. Wasn't a huge amount of time. But as we saw in the ASP video, the recent ASP video, where it was the Canadian young man who was grappling with those two men in his garage, 15, 20 seconds is a lifetime when you have to go hand to hand with somebody. Yeah.
Especially, you know, I think, unfortunately, a lot of people in private security and even some cops get the impression that just being big is enough. You don't need any skills to go with it. And anyone who's done a year of jujitsu or taekwondo can tell you that's not true at all. Size matters. That's why they have weight classes, right?
Right.
But if me and Dig are squaring off and he has years of martial arts experience and I just happen to be 2 inches taller and 70 pounds heavier than him, that's not going to do me any good, really. It has to do with skill. It sounds like this guy was hired to be, you know, the goon squad or whatever for this house and like to do stuff like this. And it sounds like he wasn't very prepared. Like he didn't know what he was doing, because restraining someone is an art. Just restraining someone, knowing how to do that effectively, is an art form. And if you're big and out of shape, man, 20 seconds, 15, 20 seconds is an eternity. If you don't have any cardio, if you're not in shape to do that sort of thing, you get smoked really fast in a fight. I used to wrestle, and I didn't pay a lot of attention to cardio my first year, and I paid for it. I never won a single match because I got smoked. Within 2 minutes, I was out of steam.
Yeah, wrestling will learn you. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. You realize you have muscles you didn't know existed. You use them in any other context. The wrestling muscles, these tiny little muscles all over your body. You're like, well, why does that hurt? What does that do?
Right.
So you're now inside. They're scrapping, and he starts to get away, but then the caretaker, you said, was able to grab him by the lower body. Does he tackle him again, or does he just restrain him, or what happened?
The caretaker is on the ground. He's like on his hands and knees, and he's clearly winded, clearly like you say, he wasn't trained for this, and he was just trying to do his best to keep this guy from coming towards us. And as the kid got somewhat loose and got his lower, I don't know if it was literally just his legs or his ankle or his waist was controlled, it was enough to keep him from running towards us further, but his upper body and his arms were free. So the kid picked up one handful of rocks. We had like pebbles, large pebbles in our driveway, and he hurled it at us behind our door. And at that moment, my wife, God bless her, decided she's going to slam the door shut just in the nick of time, because we're all standing there. And at that, it was like the glass shattered at the moment that the door was closing. So wow. I would say 75% of the glass was outside the house, but some of it did get in like a little fan-shaped pattern. So it's like the door was...
Field.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we didn't see what happened because we had just slammed the door shut in that moment. So I don't know exactly if the kid advanced further or what happened, but then we went to a window that we have near the door and we saw the kid running back. So he'd gotten free at this point. Actually, he threw more rocks. Then because we heard more rocks hit our window and door. And that's when we were looking out the window. And then we saw through the window the kid running back towards the horses. He ran through the horse corral and then turned left to run back towards the house that he was staying at into the street. We don't know exactly where he went after that, but they did eventually get him back in. And that was the beginning. That was the catalyst for a lot of things, including conversations, including calling the police, having to file a report. Extended conversations with our neighbors, the people who managed and ran that place, because we found it absolutely unacceptable that this would happen. Because we didn't have firearms in the house at that time, but we couldn't help but have that conversation, like, what if this had escalated? What if we did have firearms at that point in time? Nobody would have wanted to be involved in a shooting. And yet, theoretically, if somebody's attacking you with rocks on your property, trying to get into your house, I mean, who knows where that could have gone? But the idea of having to do anything defensively against somebody who was autistic and having whatever kind of an episode meltdown was really like upsetting and left some, you know, some scars on us as a family, and definitely left some scars on my son at who was 3 or 4 at the time. He was like quite traumatized by this experience on our property in our house. And so we had conversations with the neighboring business. They ended up eventually putting up greater fencing. Like, they didn't have any kind of security fencing. They've done stuff. They've taken steps since then to help keep that from happening. But really, and it, you know what? It did happen. And not to that degree, but there, we had other experiences where people who were in their care got off of their property and came to our house. And in fact, we had one time where my son was sitting watching TV, a different time entirely, but my son was sitting there watching TV in the middle of the afternoon in his underwear, and he looked over and there was a huge big guy standing at the window just staring in at him, who was from across the street. Right. And he ran and got me, and he was quite scared. And I looked over and I saw the guy just standing there staring into our house, and I came into the house and the guy ran off. So we've had more than one incident with the folks from across the street. And again, it's a tricky situation because we're dealing with people who have a mental situation that doesn't negate our need and right to be safe in our property.
Right. So that is the balance there. And it's so very difficult. As you probably know, you know, I have a family member who's autistic, and his parents have no end of worry, you know, about what might happen to him down the road if he gets encountered by the police. And some of his behavior, you know, they think he's high on something or drunk or being uncooperative. And, you know, as the Widners have Cody, everybody loves Cody, but it's a constant concern for the family members of people like that. But at the same time, we had a guy on the show in the first couple of years, John, and that one's entitled The Worst Day. You can go look at that one. And that one, unfortunately, yeah, the person, very similar situation, broke in, he was naked, and he shot and killed him. And it's just awful. And this is not, you know, there's never a situation where you, hopefully, where you shoot and kill someone and start high-fiving people like it's cool or fun or that was, you know, neato. In this case, just imagine the trauma for everybody involved in that situation, to include John and his family, the family of this young man who broke in. But you can't, at the same time, regardless of why someone's breaking in, the reason you shoot someone is because you're defending life. You're defending someone's life, yours or someone else's. And if someone's coming at you with a weapon, the reason why they're doing it is kind of out the window. You have to defend yourself, right? But I'm glad both of these incidents ended without anything like that happening. Talk to us about your training journey after that, because you said it kind of kicked off. You had a new vigor for training and for self-defense. Talk to us about that.
Yes, that's 100% accurate. Right after this happened, my wife was the one who felt strongly that we needed to have a firearm in the house, and not even specifically because of our neighbors, but because it made sense to her. She's like, we should have one. And I was reluctant. I'll put it that way. I've always been, had a defensive mindset, had a mindset that I've never been anti-2A. I've always been pro-2A, but I've never had any training with a firearm. And I was apprehensive, reluctant, nervous about the concept of having something in the house that I knew enough about to know that it could be lethal. And I knew enough about to know that if you didn't know how to use it, you were a liability to yourself and to your family. But so it was this tricky situation where I was like, I hear you, to my wife, but I was also like, I'm not confident with that. And we had conversations about it, and she got me a shotgun for Christmas one year. And
I love her already, by the way, just based on that. That's fantastic.
Yes, she's a gem. And so I appreciated it, but it was like, I looked at this thing and I'm like, I don't know what to do with this safely. So I'm going to put it over here until I know what to do with it safely. And I started asking people that I know. I live in Northern Arizona. I know a ton of people who are gun owners. But as I would ask people that I know and say, hey, would you, do you know about guns? Can you, I know you own a gun. Can you teach me about how to use this? The responses I got were overwhelmingly unimpressive. And I was, just in terms of the sense of confidence that I had in their ability to convey information, their understanding of what safety was. Because right off the bat, I'm like, if I'm going to learn about this, the first thing that I want to hear from somebody's mouth is, what does it mean to be safe with a firearm? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't hearing anything remotely like that from any of the people I know. And I was like, okay, it's going to keep sitting until I, it's going to keep sitting over there until I know what to, until I have record, until I have somebody who can help me. And a friend of mine who's an armorer over in Prescott, finally, we got together with him and his wife, and we went out to the range one day and did some shooting. This was years after I got the firearm. And it kicked me into overdrive. I'm like, I need to learn more about this. I'm not the kind of person that can just do something half-assed, so to speak. If I do something,
you don't dabble in anything, right? Yeah.
No, especially something where safety and life and limb hangs in the balance. And it was fun too. I enjoyed it tremendously. And I'm like, I need to learn more about this. I need to figure out how to do this, and I need to make it a priority. It's like, I lived on a sailboat for 6 years, and learning how to sail efficiently and how to keep my people who came to visit me on the boat safe was so important. And it was a similar feeling, like learning about sailing and learning about shooting. There was like always butterflies before a range trip. There was always butterflies before pulling up the anchor. There was risk to life and limb in both endeavors, but there was also adrenaline and excitement, and also a sense of tranquility that came after the challenges were met, you know, like, so since then, and it's been a 5-year journey for me since then, I have been, what happened is that took me when I, after that range trip, I'm like, I need to learn about this. And that led me to the Active Self-Protection YouTube channel. And that was really the catalyst for expanding my knowledge, for feeling like I now know how to learn more. Because it's one thing to just say, I want to learn more, but not knowing how, short of, you know, it's like, how do you vet an instructor? There's firearms instructors everywhere. What makes a good one? So learning how to vet, learning how to make good decisions with everything from holsters to instructors to what's dry fire? How do you dry fire effectively? Who are good instructors? Well, Active Self-Protection laid all of that out for me and made it so easy and so accessible that, I mean, my gratitude to John and the crew is like infinite. It's been such an important part of my life. And I say it because I'm talking about the ethos of Active Self-Protection. To hear John talking about de-escalation, to hear John talking about what it means to be a good, sane, sober, moral, and prudent person has really, it's been like kind of coming full circle on my self-defense journey. Because I mentioned when I had that martial arts instructor who emphasized those same principles and the same concepts, I felt very much like I was back home in terms of studying a new martial art in an environment with a community that had a focus that I could resonate with and that I could appreciate. And that I'm like, yes, the most important thing isn't my draw to first shot. The most important thing is being a good, sane, sober, moral, prudent person in the first place. The draw to first shot is the last resort, but it's a necessary step to being able to be proficient. And I mean, I've just been learning about what it means to be proficient, how to train to be proficient. I dry fire probably about, I try and do it 5 times a week, and I try and make it to the range these days once a week. As you know, one of the things that's emphasized, if you can do it, is to, when you're ready and comfortable, to start competing. I've been doing that with USPSA. I'm fortunate to have been able to take classes with John and with the good Adam Winch down in Phoenix. And hey, I feel like...
Yeah. Defenders,
Defenders USA.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm a big fan. With good reason.
Yes.
And I feel like my life has been, interestingly enough, my life has been enriched, and I have become a better person because of my entry into the world of not just being a gun owner, but a firearm, somebody who trains with firearms. Because again, I was a gun owner for a couple of years prior to training, and that didn't affect me. But when I began training in a conscious way, deliberately, with guidance and mentorship from the likes of these people that I'm referencing, it's changed me profoundly. It's changed how I live, how I act, how I think, how I interact with my family, my goals, my priorities. Everything has been uplifted, I would say. And I also want to give a shout out to Mr. Tim Herron, because Tim Herron was my first firearms instruction class, so to speak. It was remote, but it was still a class. And you don't know what you don't know. I knew a little bit about him. I'd heard about him. I knew that at this point he was my first. And I'm like, I feel like I've made a good decision to invest in this learning experience with Tim. But I had little comprehension of how amazing this man was. And for him to sit and talk with me and analyze my video and kind of take me under his wing and say, just focus on your fundamentals. You know, I had all these questions. He's like, just focus on a couple of fundamentals right now. Cause he would see my videos. And I look back at those videos that I sent him and it's like, oh my goodness. Thank you, Tim.
Natural progression of things. Literally, we got to start somewhere. I do want to seize on something that you said a moment ago. You don't know what you don't know. One of my big missions in life, graduating from the government? No, I retired from the government. After retiring from the government, is to do something like I'm doing now, but really with an emphasis on, look, you get a new person at a gun store. Let's not point and laugh. Let's not mock them and make fun of them. If you have an anti-2A, an anti-gun relative, shouting slogans to them is not going to help. It's not going to make any difference. Coming alongside people, like you described a moment ago, and you know, making the investment in their life is the way to change hearts and minds. That's why we really try to avoid even the hint of an agenda, political agenda or politics. You know, if you pull me to the side, I'll tell you how I vote and why I vote that way. But one of our big missions here is, hey, self-protection is a fundamental human right. The Second Amendment is for everybody, you know, not just Democrats or Republicans or libertarians or black people, white people, Asian people, all the people get the Second Amendment. And if we don't start moving in that direction, sort of in our mindset about spreading the word and educating people, we're never going to get anywhere. If you are just haranguing people and calling them, you know, names on the internet and creating memes, you're part of the problem. You're not part of the solution. So I love to hear stories like that. And I think it really dovetails nicely with what we're doing at Active Self-Protection and what we're trying to do anyway. We're getting towards the top of the hour here. I want to ask if there's anything else that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to talk about, because I don't want to leave anything out, sir. See, there, called you, sir.
There. Yeah, I know, right? I didn't even notice. I mean, it makes sense to me. No, I think that, I mean, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, and I'm grateful to be here. You mentioned something though that I will you made me think of something that I'm involved with right now.
Okay.
That other people who you are going to know are also taking part in this webinar series with David Yamane, I think is how you say his name. Mm-hmm. And he's the professor of sociology over at Wake Forest. You were talking about how getting people to understand and appreciate the Second Amendment, to have a different understanding of firearms, to have a different relationship, isn't about yelling slogans. It's not about like us against them. It's about we're all in this together.
Right.
And David has a new book out. I think it's called Gun Culture 2.0. And he's been doing a webinar series that a bunch of people, like I know that, like I'll see Tim Reedy on the conversations. I'll see a lot of different people who I recognize as range master instructors or what have you, who are participating in this webinar series. And in it, David Professor Yamane is talking about this very topic. And I say this because it is a free webinar, and I'm glad that I'm able to be part of it. And it's an interesting thing, especially for people. I think people who are watching this are going to tend to skew more pro 2A. But sure. For those people, we all know people who aren't. And it's great and important, I think, to have resources to communicate with those people who aren't. This is something that I think about as a person who is actively preparing to go before a government and plead the case for the right of people to have access to tools for self-defense. I'm always looking at resources that I can garner for, hey, it's not just about right-wing Republicans on a mission to whatever. It's about it's a right. It's a human right. It should be a universal human right. It shouldn't just be an American. I mean, I use the word should. Maybe should's not the right word, but I think of it as, I don't care if you live in Thailand or in Australia or New Zealand or Africa or South America, wherever. I think that we all, especially, and it's like that becomes so clear to everyone as soon as you're in a life-threatening situation. You're like, oh wow, now I wish I had something, but you know, until then,
have something to protect myself with. But yeah, that's another thing I wanted to bring up before we part ways. You know, I don't think people in this country realize how special our Constitution is and how special the Second Amendment is. There is no other country that I'm aware of on earth that guarantees in its founding documents the right to keep and bear arms. And if we don't, you know, if we don't defend it, if we don't protect it, it can go away. That can happen. And when I say that, again, I want to emphasize, I don't mean yelling at people. I don't mean calling people libtards or whatever stupid stuff you got on top of your head. That is counterproductive in the extreme. And I think the most important thing to remember is not just to fight it out politically or to write your senator, but the most important thing you can do, it's like my Christian faith informs me to have a defense for the faith that lies in my heart. You should feel that way about the Second Amendment. You should be prepared to discuss it with people and have answers. When they challenge you with a question, be ready to answer it. Have this stuff thought through, because that's the only way we're going to make any difference in the world, is one-on-one or small groups of people discussing, you know, your friend at work or your buddy at the, you know, that you play down the Y with or whatever, ask you, hey, you carry a gun, talk to me about it. Be ready for that and be prepared to have something intelligent to say, something reasonable to say that doesn't alienate people. And that's all I'm going to say about that. And I'm going to wrap it up there. Dig, man, I can't thank you enough for...
Likewise, I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's been an absolute blast. Hopefully I'll get to meet you in meat space, as they say, one of these years. We don't look that far apart. Don't hang up on me. I got to talk to you when we're done here. Folks, if you made it this far, thank you so much. If you're watching on the app especially, thank you so much. You're helping, you know, if you're paying for that app, you're helping to fund our work. And I think our work is important. I say it every week when I talk to Stephen Gutowski over at The Reload. If he didn't have membership dues, he'd have to go do something else. This work literally just wouldn't get done. And I don't know anyone, hang on one second. I don't know anyone else out there who is doing the work that Active Self-Protection is doing, the work that John, Neil, Steph, and the whole gang are doing. So you wanted to add one more thing, Dig? I'm sorry.
I did, yeah. I wanted to mention about the Active Self-Protection Unlimited app. One of my favorite parts of the Active Self-Protection Unlimited app are the classes. I love everything about it, but in particular, what has made it more than worthwhile, more than worth the nominal investment in it, have been the classes. The classes have been a goldmine of information, so useful to me on so many levels. The replay value of the classes, I've watched many of them multiple times, from Memphis Beach's dry fire class to Riley Bowman, pistol intelligence, and Tim Heron's, performance shooting, Melody Lauer's class for parents on how to be a guardian and a defender as a parent. There are so many classes, and there's continually more classes being added. To pay for that content, I would expect to pay hundreds, if not thousands, more than what is being charged for the Active Self-Protection app. So that right there is like, I'm always telling people, I'm always like on forums, community forums, Facebook groups, whatever, saying, if you don't subscribe to it, you might want to consider it, because it's very, very worthwhile. Adam Winch has a new class that just came out on there, the Fighting Handgun course, which, I mean, anyway, I could go on and on about that, Adam, but I'll let you guys do that.
You're listening, Adam, and you should be. I fully expect you to reach out to me and Dig and thank me and him for two plugs in one show. That's free advertising right there. So check him out, Defenders USA, and he's on the app as well. So with that, Dig, I'm going to part ways. Thank you so much for watching or listening to this show. Do me a favor and go write a review. Give us a 5-star review. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. We're always trying to adapt and grow. I'm getting better at editing. Thanks to a fan who was an editing person and reached out to me. So shout out to him. I'll be seeing him again this week to learn some more about editing. So that's how this whole thing works. So once again, Dig, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.